All right. Well, it's about 5 minutes after the hour. I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight for Let's Talk Non-Clinical Jobs. And tonight, joining me is Dr. Stephen Peskin, Joseph Kim, founder of nonclinicaljobs.com. And I believe a number of you have participated in some of our previous calls, whether it was the part one of the physician careers in the pharmaceutical industry, or if it was another call. I want to thank you for being here tonight. As a reminder, if you need to mute your line, you can push star and then number 6, and then that will toggle the mute on and off, and you will hear a prompt if you use that command. Without further ado, I mean, I think you all have had a chance to read about Stephen Peskin on the website as you've registered and signed up for this call tonight, so I don't want to really get into that other than just to summarize that he is Chief Medical Officer as well as Executive Vice President of MetaMedia USA. And tonight is a continuation of the conversation that we began several weeks ago, where we're talking about different types of physician careers in the pharmaceutical industry. And I'll be asking Stephen some questions, and we're tonight going to be drilling down into more specific types of jobs, such as jobs related to pharmacovigilance, drug safety officers, as well as the world of medical affairs and sales, MSLs, or medical science liaison jobs, and some other jobs related to medical communications and medical writing and some consulting that can also be done directly for the pharmaceutical industry. Our hope tonight is to really have more of a conversational mode where I'll ask some questions of Stephen, and then we'll kind of open it up and see what kinds of questions you all may have, and then we'll kind of move on to some other topics, talk about a few topics, and then have some interactive Q&A in the middle as well. So I hope that you all have some questions, or that as you listen to this, as you listen to the discussion, if you have questions, please make sure you jot those down. So without further ado, Stephen, thank you again for joining us tonight.
My pleasure, Joe.
So one of the first things that I wanted to start on tonight is really just talking about this whole concept of pharmacovigilance, as well as these jobs that are often advertised as drug safety officer positions. And can you start by just explaining what do these people do who hold these positions, and what kind of skill sets, other than just having a physician's degree or having some clinical experience, is really required to get into some of these pharmacovigilance jobs?
Sure. It's certainly one of the areas that we believe is a bit of an easier entree from clinical practice into the pharmaceutical industry. The jobs really entail looking at information that may come in from physicians, physician offices, hospitals, patients, other places where information is coming in to the company from a toll-free number, from the web, and where there are concerns being raised about possible adverse events called AEs or SAEs, serious adverse events. And really the skills involved, it's being able to look at the information, compare what's being said to what are the known potential problems that have been understood based on clinical trials, the adverse events, known adverse events for that drug, the skill of investigation, of writing, of documentation would really be important in this job. So it is a job that has certainly an important attention to detail and documentation, and good and written communication skills would be things that I would see as being important in pharmacovigilance and drug safety.
Now, what about, Stephen, what about in terms of career progression? People who enter into these areas, where, if any, you know, how do they grow within these positions, if at all?
So once you're in an organization, in a pharmaceutical company, you will begin to really understand with much greater clarity and insight what really are the other opportunities, because part of what the company does when they bring you on is they're really making an investment in you. And companies really do want to see their employees succeed. They want people to be able to look at growth opportunities should you choose to grow in your career. So once you come into a pharmaceutical company of any size, there will be an opportunity to learn more about different parts of the company that will be made available to you in training, and both formal and informal, as you meet people, colleagues, talk to your immediate supervisor. So really, once you are in the company, you will have the ability to learn and understand, gain insights, again, both formally and informally, and then you will be able to ascertain in what other directions you may choose to go, some of the other things that we're going to be talking about tonight.
Okay. Yeah, great. Thanks for those insights. I know that whenever I talk to colleagues who work in the pharmaceutical industry, they talk about the need to balance sort of what I would call internal corporate roles as well as field positions. And depending on your level, they like to see people get well-rounded. And so they may put you in the field for 1 or 2 years where you're traveling, perhaps as an MSL, and then afterwards maybe work in some kind of corporate position where you're managing a group of people or a team. And I know that a number of folks that I know have moved around quite a bit. And the pharmacovigilance, that whole role seems to be a good entry point for physicians. So at this point, what I will say, I want to open it up to the audience, to those who are participating, to just see whether or not anyone has any specific questions as it relates to pharmacovigilance or this whole concept of being a drug safety officer. Any questions? And of course, if you don't get a chance to ask your question now, there's always going to be the opportunity at the end of the call as well.
This is Heather Fork from Yep. Thank you very much. I had a question. When you mentioned that once somebody gets into the company, then they're more able to understand what their career progression would be like, and it sounds like you may be talking more about some of those possibilities in this call, so you don't need to talk about that now. So it's going to be covered later. But if someone's just trying to think about, if I did this initial job where I take the information about adverse events, but I don't think I'd really like that, but I think I might like something later on. Is there a way they can kind of get a potential idea of what other things they might be doing? Or if they were going to be doing traveling for the first couple of years, is there a good chance that then they wouldn't have to do traveling after they made that investment?
Right. You know, so, Heather, you really described two different options.
Right.
The drug safety officer pharmacovigilance is going to be more of your prototypical desk job, computer and telephone job, and then a first level job that does involve quite a lot of travel would be, as Joe described, a field-based position where you would be interacting on behalf of the company with clinical investigators, with physicians who are affectionately known as opinion leaders or key opinion leaders or key thought leaders, and individuals who do a lot of speaking, who write a lot of papers, who are influential in that particular therapeutic area. So that field-based job would really be, quite different from the pharmacovigilance drug safety officer job.
Yeah, and the one thing that I would add, Heather, is, and we've talked about this at length in the past too, really the best way for people to learn and to get exposed to these kinds of positions is to try to talk to as many physicians that they can who work in these different roles. One thing that I've learned is that whether, say, you're a drug safety officer at Pfizer, what you do there at Pfizer could be actually fairly different from what you do at Merck or J&J or Novartis. The same thing goes true for an MSL. The same thing goes true for someone who works in clinical research, because the corporate cultures within company to company to company can vary tremendously, as well as the roles, responsibilities, and even opportunities one may get exposed to. So it helps to really just try to talk with many people, and that's ultimately done through networking. But until you put your foot through the door and actually start exploring actively, it's going to be difficult to really get a sense of what is possible.
Just to build on what Joe's good comment that it, using a specific example of a field-based person, there are physicians who will focus largely on academic health centers, and then others who might focus very significantly on payers, third-party payers, healthcare plans, pharmacy benefit managers. Others may focus on specific non-academic institutions. So in terms of that, to Joe's point about it, it can look quite different from company to company. And within a company, there may be a certain amount of specialization, even within that field-based position.
Right.
Thank you.
Sure. Other questions regarding pharmacovigilance or drug safety? Otherwise, we will move on, and as I mentioned earlier, you can always ask your question towards the end as well. Okay, well, in that case, since we're talking about field-based positions, I think one position that often comes up is the position of an MSL. And the medical science liaison, as they're typically called, although they're called other things in different companies, is an area that continues to evolve. And in the past, I know the trend was that companies hired people who had a PharmD, a PhD, as well as an MD, to be MSLs, to be out on the field. And some of the things that I've heard from my colleagues who work in pharma are that companies are moving more towards MDs and DOs as MSLs and less relying on the PharmDs, the PhDs. And so I guess some questions to Stephen are, number one, is that the trend that you're seeing as well? And number two, what do these MSLs really do, and how can people ultimately learn more about these MSL jobs and get their foot into the door to try to get an MSL job?
Yeah, so Joe, in terms of credential, as you said about variability among companies, I would say that's also true for a field-based position. I was at Abbott Laboratories on Wednesday, and kind of a different name they use, CENO, sounds like some kind of insurance that one might get, but it's Clinical Expert in Outcomes. I'm not sure how they came up with that, but that's what they call it. And then I know one of my neighbors was a regional medical research scientist, an RMRS at Pfizer, so different from medical science liaison. So the titles will oftentimes vary, but the one that is the most commonly used is medical science liaison. And Joe, to your question, I'm not sure that I would agree that there's a strong trend toward MDs and DOs in those roles. It still seems that the PharmDs, occupy those roles in greater numbers. That said, there certainly are ample opportunities for physicians in the scientific liaison role. One of the things we talked about a few weeks ago is that though the MSL job, frequently when you see it advertised, they will, as is oftentimes the case in jobs, say 3 to 5 years of experience required. Well, how the heck do I get experience? It's the old chicken or the egg. And we talked about that there are companies that hire medical science liaisons and train them and then outsource in an outsource fashion. So that may be a bit of an easier way to crack the code, as it were, for a medical science liaison role, is with a company such as SOS, Science Oriented Solutions, which is a division of Publicis, and that division happens to be based in Atlanta. So there are others where they will hire physicians and PharmDs and PhDs, train them, and then we'll get contracts with pharmaceutical companies. When you're working in that fashion, you do carry the card of the pharmaceutical company, not the card of the organization that's actually employing you.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that one of the frequent questions that comes up is, how much travel is really involved when you're working as an MSL? Can you comment on that?
It is a travel-heavy job. I would say that, you know, you can expect to be on the road at least 50% of the time. And that being on the road may be regional, and it may be in a car as opposed to on an airplane. Certainly in a densely populated area like the Washington to Boston area, that scientific liaison role will have a dense, sort of geographic concentration given the number of institutions in a fairly small geography.
Sure.
You get out into more sparsely populated parts of the country, and you may, be finding yourself on a plane quite often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know several people who've worked as MSLs, and it sounds like, out of the people that I know at least, after about a year and a half, they just really get burned out from all the travel. And I think for many folks who have not really ever worked in the corporate environment, this whole concept of travel requirements, 25%, 30%, 50%, 75%, seems really nebulous. You know, how do they really come up with a percentage? Can you comment on what does it really mean if a job requirement states 50% travel? Does that mean that literally 2 weeks out of the four-week month they're going to be gone? Like, how do you think, or how do they come up with these percentages, and what does that really translate to?
Yeah, it is certainly an approximation of a number of institutions, and you'll work with your direct manager in terms of the frequency with which you have to sort of routinely be at that institution. So I was with a scientific liaison from Novartis recently, and he lives in Washington, and when he goes to University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, he certainly will fly, and he's there, I would say, at least once a month. So that, and then the travel, obviously, in terms of where you've got more than one institution in fairly close proximity. So if you're able to sort of group the travel, or kill proverbial two birds with one stone, you're in the Raleigh-Durham Chapel Hill area, and you're at Duke and UNC Chapel Hill in the same trip, the travel might look a bit less because you've sort of bundled your trips. But I would say, the expectation is you're going to be kind of away from home at least, a couple of days a week in those type of roles. Joe, what's been your experience?
Yeah, I mean, that's been my experience as well. I know a number of folks who have, even if they were geographically living in one area of the country, perhaps their coverage or their territory, so to speak, involved a different part, and then they were just literally always flying in and out, racking up a lot of miles on airlines, living out of a hotel, living out of a suitcase, and some really didn't mind it, but I know a lot of people were, after a year of that or after a year and a half, they said, that's enough, I need something else, and so then they moved on. And so it just seems like it's largely also dependent from company to company based on the pressures that are put on you. But the trend, it seems like, at least with a lot of these pharma companies that they're now merging and acquiring one another, is that they're not investing resources to grow and expand their sales force in huge numbers, but if anything, the sales forces are contracting, and a lot of the MSL teams are also contracting. And what I don't know is, as those teams are contracting, whether that translates into more responsibilities literally being dumped onto fewer people, or if they're trying to somehow change their model altogether. So that's the part that still seems a little bit nebulous to me. I haven't talked to folks recently, for instance, who used to be at Wyeth and now it's Pfizer, or Merck sharing Plough, these companies especially that have recently merged, where the corporate cultures have now been replaced. And I haven't had a chance to sit down and pick their brains or hear about their stories, but I know that those are some of the issues that have often come up. And I also know a number of MSLs who've recently been laid off because just as their groups have merged and have contracted, they've lost their jobs. And so they're out there also looking as well. Questions from the audience?
Yourself, the folks on the phone, where you can demonstrate to a particular company or potential hiring company, that you have insight and understanding into the audiences that these field-based physicians and PharmDs and PhDs are targeting. So if you've, for example, been involved in your hospital formulary or P&T committee, if, for example, you've had interaction with healthcare plans, health insurance companies, beyond the normal frustration that practicing physicians have with prior authorization and utilization review and the like, if you've served on a technology assessment committee or a quality or credentialing committee. So any experience that you have that translates to the pharmaceutical company saying, Dr. Kim really understands my customer, and so he would be a good fit for an MSL because he understands some of that ways in which Aetna works or United Healthcare, and that's part of what the job would entail, would be to be the outward face of the pharmaceutical company around products and portfolio and health management programs and the like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great point. Great point. Thanks. Questions from the audience. This question about the topic of MSL seems to be one that's fairly popular, and so we'll just open it up for a few minutes for anyone to ask questions. Otherwise, like I said earlier, we can always tackle these questions at the end of the call as well. Any questions on this topic of MSL?
I would also just say, Joe, that if this is a job that you seriously consider, certainly you want to be able to convey to the potentially hiring company your enthusiasm toward interacting with peers and that sort of social aspect of it, if you will. I mean, it's a serious job. It involves science and all of that, and talking to clinical investigators about phase 3 or phase 4 clinical trials and so forth. But you do want to be able to demonstrate that you're a person that's comfortable in conversation and interaction, social interaction, and so forth, because that's part of it as well.
Yeah, that's definitely a great point. Well, let's move on our discussion to the next topic, which is medical writers. And I know that within this, the whole healthcare medical communication industry, the medical writer, you know, professional medical writer, can be someone who does anywhere from, you know, drug safety reports and regulatory writing, all the way to creative writing, consumer writing, writing books, to scientific writing, medical education, and marketing and promotional things. And I know that a number of pharmaceutical companies even hire medical writers internally. They've got their own medical writing staff, or in many cases, they're hiring contract medical writers. So, Stephen, comments about medical writing, I mean, this is a whole field in and of itself, but just as it relates more specifically to, maybe we'll talk about jobs specifically within the pharmaceutical, where the company themselves will be hiring. Any comments there, or your thoughts about, you know, what are some of these medical writing jobs, what do they entail, and what do they really look like from the inside?
Yeah, my experience with medical writers or medical writing is that it is much more often a non-core function of the pharmaceutical company. The expectation that people in medical affairs and in pharmacovigilance, medical safety, have good, solid writing skills. The medical writers, the individuals who are writing dossiers or who are writing the participating with the investigators in writing for refereed, for peer-reviewed journals, that type of writing tends to be done by companies or freelancers who are working through a company or even individually directly with a pharmaceutical company as not a full-time employee. Now, Joe mentioned that some writing is of a bit more of a creative nature in promotional education, and that is absolutely another facet of the writing as opposed to the more rigorous type of writing that would be for peer-reviewed journals or for abstracts or poster sessions at congresses and scientific conferences. So that more promotional writing is another type of writing that is done, and then it gets even into the type of writing that is directed toward patients or consumers, non-healthcare professionals. So that's another facet of medical communication, medical writing as well. My own experience is, again, that individuals in pharmaceutical companies that are on product teams or in medical affairs, the expectation is that they are good writers or have decent writing skills. A lot of the more lengthy, heavy lifting, if you will, writing is going to be done by a vendor or supplier to the pharmaceutical company.
Yeah, and that's probably been what I've seen as well. I think that, and I know that companies that have internal medical writing teams, at least within different pharmaceutical companies, a lot of them tend to really just focus more around what I will call regulatory writing and dealing more with just the clinical studies and just having a team in-house that can take care of a lot of those things. But I also know that a number of them hire contractors on a regular basis, and some of these contract jobs may run 6 months, 9 months, 12 months. And so my experience has been that most physicians, if they don't have any formal experience in regulatory writing, as specific as that topic gets, that it's very difficult for them to break in because there's a lot to learn just within that whole field of regulatory writing. But as it relates more to what I will call scientific writing or educational writing or writing review articles and promotional educational content, those are areas where it's easier for people to break in without ever having any formal training, formal education, or formal experience in any of those areas. So I think writing is a career in and of itself, and I know many writers where they've just focused on a particular angle or a particular section of the whole medical writing field. You know, the American Medical Writers Association, or AMWA, AMWA, has a number of different chapter meetings as well as annual meetings and resources on their website that outline all the different types of medical writing career opportunities that are out there. So for those on the call, I would encourage you to visit AMWA to sort of research the different types of careers. Almost all of them are going to deal directly or indirectly with a pharmaceutical company client, quote unquote, so to speak, although some may be more consumer health oriented and may not really interface directly with a pharmaceutical company. But the vast majority of them do deal with this industry, and so it's a good way to at least learn about it and get exposed. So
yeah, thing I'd say about writing, and we don't really think about this as writing, but it is so much woven into the fabric of the pharmaceutical industry, is the writing of slides. So a lot of what end product is that's used in communication today, for better or for worse, and some people talk about PowerPointless or PowerPoint. We've dumbed down ourselves to everything has to be able to be on a PowerPoint slide. So the reality is that a lot of communication is on slides. So your ability to be able to demonstrate that you have been involved in developing slides or what they call slide decks with speaker's notes is another way to kind of think about what the work product is when you're talking about medical writing as it relates to the biopharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, that's a great point. I know that the whole writing industry has really moved away from manuscript writing and much more into PowerPoint slides and presentations. And the nice thing about the internet today is that you, as one of the listeners, even if you don't have any formal experience in healthcare communications, if you wanted to develop some PowerPoint slides on a particular topic that you are really interested in, make sure that graphs and charts and things like that are referenced, and you can actually upload these onto different PowerPoint slide sharing websites like SlideShare and others that makes these PowerPoint slides that's now available into the public domain. And people might search for something, they may search for a certain term, they may even stumble upon your presentation, and you can even link these to your LinkedIn profile. And if someone sees this deck and they're pretty impressed by the slides that you've developed, they may actually approach you, even if you've never had any formal experience getting paid to develop a slide deck. So I think that's just something else to keep in mind, that if this is an area that you're interested in, to make sure that you hone your PowerPoint presentation skills and that you are familiar and comfortable using PowerPoint, but that's certainly an excellent point. Questions from the audience about medical writing, and not so much within that whole umbrella industry, but just more as it relates specifically to how the pharmaceutical and the biotechnology industry. Any questions at all?
This is Heather, and I had a question. I've heard some people comment that when you mention physicians doing medical writing, they'll say, oh, physicians are too expensive, industries are really trying to use them less and use non-physicians, and obviously there's certain things only physicians can do, but I'm just curious if you're seeing a trend away from having physician writers.
Well, I'll comment on that first, and I'll say that as it relates specifically to physician writers, my experience has been that what they charge actually can vary quite a bit. So on average, if we were to say that medical writers or contractors, freelancers, are charging anywhere from $50 an hour to $150 an hour, then I know some physicians where they charge on the lower end, not as low as 50, but maybe less than 100, as well as some that charge 150 an hour or more. So I think depending on the type of work that needs to be done, if you're talking about an area that's highly scientific, where there's a lot of details in the data and the science, and by that I mean maybe topics that deal more with like immunology, rheumatology, oncology, things that are molecularly based, people are going to generally tend to gravitate more towards highly educated writers, people who have a PharmD, PhD, or an MD, and generally less from those writers out there who maybe have a bachelor's degree or a master's degree. And so it varies. But I think that ultimately, if you can really sell yourself as an expert in a particular therapeutic area and demonstrate that expertise, and you don't have to be on the highest end of the pay scale, but if you're somewhere in the mid to upper end and clients are looking for people who have that expertise in those specific areas, then I think you'll always have opportunities. If, on the other hand, you are a physician and you tend to specialize in more general writing, say things like depression or basic diabetes management or just hypertension, things that are more general topics, it's going to be harder to compete because they may be able to find someone who's got, say, a master's degree or a PhD and who might not be charging as much. Maybe not at somewhere in the range of $80 to $120 an hour. Maybe it'll be tough to compete if you're expecting $150 an hour. So it really does depend, I think, on two main things. One is, what is the topic? You know, what is the therapeutic area? And is it an area that's so complex that they really need someone high science? And the second is, have you established yourself to be able to demonstrate real value to your clients? Stephen, any comments from you at all?
We're paying our writers typically in the 115 to 150 range for the various outsourced medical writing that we employ outside medical writers at MediMedia, and certainly we're paying for what we perceive to be very high quality writers. Most of them are not physicians. Occasionally they are, but for the most part, they're PharmDs or PhDs. We have some very specialized type of writing that we employ writers for that has to weave in and blend in pharmacoeconomics, health economic outcomes, and that specialization commands a bit of a premium from some of the writers that we use.
Yeah, the other comment that I'll make is that in the past, I think we can safely admit that there were a number of companies that were into the practice of ghostwriting, where literally the company themselves wrote the entire manuscript and had very little to zero input from the academic faculty members. In today's environment, that kind of practice really doesn't exist anymore, or it practically doesn't exist. I think it's going to be very rare to find an organization that employs such practices. And therefore, there's much more input from the faculty. There's much more input and interactions going back and forth from the academic faculty members. And therefore, you don't have to be a physician, for instance, to be able to write up a case, because you're going to get a lot of that input from your faculty presenters. Or you don't have to be a physician to be able to write up a monograph or a newsletter on a particularly clinical topic, because, once again, you're going to get that input. So, Stephen's point, someone who's got a PhD, a PharmD, someone who's never even touched a patient, can still write very powerful clinical case vignettes and write clinical content because they get so much input from the faculty. Now, that didn't really be the case. That wasn't always the case, but given the changes that have occurred as well as the evolution within this whole industry, my personal experience has been that that is much more the norm today, to have to really involve the faculty, to get them to get a heavy amount of their input as you're developing the content, whether it's a PowerPoint deck, whether it's a monograph, whether it's a clinical case of some kind. And so the value of simply having that clinical experience and the value of having that MD or DO after your name, you're actually more on the same level as someone who's got a PhD or PharmD. And I think you have to price yourself as such as well. If you don't, I think then it's going to be tough to compete. Other questions on this topic of medical writing? Now, I know that we've got other people on the line, but I think people are either just shy to ask or they're just soaking everything in, so I'm not really sure which it is. But if there aren't any other questions, then perhaps we'll move on. So one of the questions that came up following our call last time was for us to just explore a little bit more about the differences. The differences between promotional medical education versus certified CME, continuing medical education. And, Stephen, I guess I was wondering if you could just kind of expand on, if I'm a physician, I've never worked in medical communications before, and I'm looking at two different jobs. One is a job in the promotional MedEd company, MedEd being medical education. One is in a certified CME medical education company. What would be sort of the pros and cons of one job, one type of job, or one type of company versus the other? Can you give us some thoughts there?
Sure. So if you are interested in a job where you're really more deeply involved with working, in a sense, shoulder to shoulder with the pharmaceutical company because you think you might want to work for a pharmaceutical company, then in today's environment, you certainly need to be working in what Joe described as promotional medical education, non-accredited. And the reason is because with continuing medical education or ACCME or certified medical education, whether it be for physicians or nurse practitioners or pharmacists or PAs or what have you, that now is strongly separated, and the pharmaceutical companies cannot be involved directly at all in selecting the faculty, selecting the way the education is developed and delivered. It is done truly through a grant, and then the entity that that's been awarded the grant, whether that be the American College of Cardiology or Joe Kim's company or Projects in Knowledge or another Open CME, CME Outfitters, they will then be accountable for developing the program, the educational activities, the educational design, pulling adult learning principles, and that sort of thing within the construct of the grant that's been awarded. Now, the grant will have certain amount of specification, whether it be around live grand round events or a symposium, a CME symposium at a major medical meeting. So that ability really to have more insight in terms of the pharmaceutical company is clearly going to come from working within promotional education. If you have a love and a passion for accredited education, every physician knows what that's about. Promotional education would be education that is within the label or what's called a product information or package insert. So what that product is FDA approved and really cannot deviate outside of that, whereas in CME, the education information can deal with information that's out of label for that product.
So, Stephen, one of the comments that I often hear is that if you work in a promotional company, that you essentially become a slave to your client, you know, the client being the pharmaceutical company. They tell you what to do, and you just do it. And so you're pretty much not able to employ as much, perhaps, creativity or that kind of thing. Do you find that that's really the case? Is that truly a valid criticism of promotional med-ed?
No, the pharmaceutical companies in hiring a promotional MedCom or medical education company or clinical scientific communication company, as we talk about at MediMedia. So we talk about creating compelling scientific communication to achieve durable behavior change, and that sounds like a tagline or a slogan, and it is. And the creativity is expected and really demanded. That creativity is everything from how the information is the channels that are chosen, whether it be podcast or web seminars or written materials or satellite broadcasts that I've been involved in moderating in the past. So, and then there's creativity involved in how the information is sort of organized and arrayed, and there's creativity. Usually physicians aren't involved in this type of part of the creativity, but in terms of how the program is branded, if you will. So there's a certain amount of artwork and things like that that's involved there. So I would say that you are very much accountable to your customer, but your pharmaceutical industry client is looking for strategy, creativity, knowledge of how to develop content or promotional education so that it's going to be exciting, interesting, you know, whether it again be case-based learning that allows the individual to answer questions while they're going through the case so that the physician stays involved and engaged.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I was asking that question partly because that's a question that I often hear, and given that I work in a medical education company that strictly does CME, we actually, I think one of the downsides for us is that we don't get to employ what I would call any kind of creative marketing in terms of actually, we're not there to market a product, for instance. We're there to market our CME activity to get people to participate in the activity, but there's really limited marketing or strategies that go behind it beyond simply just trying to ensure that there's quality education. And some of the education that we develop doesn't even deal with a specific therapeutic area or disease state or drug. In some cases, it may just deal with communication. You know, how do you improve communication with your patient, or how do you improve medication adherence? These sort of generic kinds of topics. And so I think that what's interesting for me is talking with people that have worked in both the promotional side as well as the certified CME side, and to hear about what they like about one versus the other. And I know some who really love one side and really hate the other, and some who, you know, vice versa. So for those on the, you know, who are listening in the audience, I would just encourage you to make sure that you thoroughly explore what the cultures are like in both arenas before you actually decide to go in one direction or the next, if this is an area that really interests you, because the two are really very, very different. And as Stephen mentioned, in the CME side, in the certified CME side or the accredited education, there's literally zero contact with the people in the pharmaceutical company. You may know their names, you may know what they look like, because perhaps you met them at a conference or at a meeting one time, but you really don't get any much, you don't get much more interactions beyond that. And that's very, very different than the way CME used to be, you know, 10 plus years ago. It's a very interesting thing to see the evolution in this whole space of the medical communications industry, but one that, once again, the best way to get involved, the best way to learn, is to talk with people who work in this space. Any questions from the audience as it relates specifically to medical communications, medical education, or those specific areas, those jobs? All right, well, hearing none, I will just move on then, and I know that we're got about 10 minutes left before we wrap up. The last thing I wanted to tackle were just sort of general consulting opportunities. You know, what are some of the different kinds of consulting opportunities as it relates to pharmaceutical companies, whether you're A, an independent consultant, or B, whether you work, say, for a consulting firm of some kind? Stephen, your comments.
The broad consulting industry certainly services the pharmaceutical industry. So consulting, the sort of prototypical management consulting firms, whether they be Bain or McKinsey or LEK or Boston Consulting Group, the Deloitte's consulting arm, PricewaterhouseCoopers consulting arm, Ernst & Young. So all of those sort of major consulting firms that, you know, that we hear about or know of or may have friends or spouses or friends of friends, all of them have major what they call life sciences practices, and within life sciences, the pharmaceutical industry and biotechnology industry is a big part of that, also medical device and other types of medical products and so forth, and also imaging, but certainly the pharmaceutical industry is a big part of that. That consulting, formalized consulting, can be anything from how the pharmaceutical company organizes or reorganizes itself to looking at opportunities in certain therapeutic areas and what the future is from the standpoint of the epidemiology and sort of commercial and profit opportunities. So those consulting houses are certainly involved in a wide range of activities with regard to consulting engagements with pharmaceutical companies. As an individual physician, separate and apart from a consulting firm, you may have a consulting opportunity to simply be a speaker. We were talking about promotional medical education. So one way to get to know a company and to get involved in some ways can be a kind of a side door, foot in the door. Consulting would be as a paid speaker, someone who talks about hypertension or diabetes or multiple myeloma if you're an oncologist, and that may be a way to do consulting for a pharmaceutical company as it relates to the clinical and scientific and patient care knowledge that you have. If you have a particular penchant for patient education, you may actually, you know, be able to have a consulting engagement as it relates to that.
Great. Thanks for those comments. Well, we've got about 5 minutes left, and I wanted to leave some time for those on the call to ask questions about any of the topics that we discussed tonight. So at this point, I want to just open it up and see what questions people have.
Yes, hi. My name is Nish. I'm currently working in pharmacovigilance and am sort of at a loss as to how to sort of progress into a position, perhaps into another company in pharmacovigilance or into medical affairs or something else. It seems like pharmacovigilance positions are frequently pigeonholed, so to speak. So any thoughts?
So have you let it be known in the best political way that you might, Anish, as to, you know, your immediate supervisor or, you know, again, I don't want to get too personal or to be able to talk to someone in human resources at the company where you're working that demonstrates that you're an enterprising individual, someone who's got a penchant for expanding his career, someone who's very excited about working for this company, you really want to make a career here, those kinds of conversations that you would either have with your direct supervisor or someone in training or human resources, is that feasible?
Oh, yeah, so some very basic conversations, yes, I have had those, and with a feeling that perhaps moving on may be the best option. So just wondering
so falling on deaf ears, you don't feel like your voice is being heard, that you're not being taken seriously. Have you posted for any positions in the corporate intranet in other areas and been shut down or?
No, not that. Not quite that officially, but just a word of mouth conversation.
I see. Yeah, so, I mean, the good news is that you do have, you know, the credential. You're working for a pharmaceutical company, so that, Joe, weigh in here, but I think that makes your resume to executive search or to potential hiring managers at other companies immediately more attractive.
Yeah, I mean, my comments would be the same as what Stephen has mentioned, and to also just, without knowing more about the details, for instance, like, you know, how long have you been employed there, and are you living in an area where you have access to multiple other companies, or are you in a geographic area, say, in Chicago or, you know, Eli Lilly, where unless you were to relocate, it would be difficult to find another job. But in many cases, it may be more difficult to work vertically within your own organization, and it might be easier to make a vertical move by transitioning into a different company altogether, like you said. And if you look at a number of different physicians who work in pharma who are, for instance, like on LinkedIn or some of these social networking websites, you'll actually see that one of the trends is that they're from company to company to company, staying maybe 2 years here, 3 years there, 1 year here. And although that kind of jumping around in the past was kind of looked down upon, in a lot of ways it's almost a new norm. It's almost like the new trend, especially amongst younger employees, those who fall into the millennial generation, Generation Y. And so I don't want to say that that's definitely going to be the best move to look elsewhere, to perhaps look for a vertical move somewhere else, but it might be. And the other considerations are really just to see what kind of relationships have you built internally within your own organization, because perhaps the HR person is not going to be your strongest advocate, but maybe there are other people, and that those other people might not be your direct supervisor. It might be an indirect supervisor or someone who's at a higher level but just in a completely different division, department. So I think it's kind of outside of the scope of this call tonight, but I would say that those are some things to consider and to see how you might be able to leverage those relationships, that aspect of networking, to see where you can go from here.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Sure. Any other questions tonight from anyone else on the call?
Yes, this is Amy. I just have a really basic question, which is I used to be board certified, and I let that lapse in 2000, and I've been doing insurance physicals for 7 years, so I've not been doing patient care. First of all, I'm assuming that one needs to be board certified to even apply for any of these jobs. Is that correct?
That is not correct. Actually, many of these positions are available to people who either have limited residency experience or even no residency experience here in the United States. Some people have these positions, and by these positions, I'm kind of encompassing everything that we talked about tonight, and I don't think any particular position that we spoke about tonight requires either A, active medical license, or B, board certification. Now, they may say board certification preferred, but given that many of these roles that we spoke about tonight are filled by either a physician, a PharmD, or someone who's got a PhD, they're kind of lumped into the same category as those folks. So I would say that if you're interested in any of the things that we discussed tonight, it's possible to get, even if you don't have board certification or board renewal or even an active medical license.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. There, as people transition into industry and they find it increasingly difficult and perhaps not necessary to maintain active licensure, board recertification, MOC maintenance of certification, or come into industry after medical school or after 1 year of a rotating internship without doing a complete residency. So there certainly are opportunities without you going through the process of recertification.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure. Any other questions tonight from the audience? We've got just a couple minutes left.
This is Heather, and I have a question, but if anybody else has one, I can defer. My question is kind of a general question in terms of if you looked at all the different non-clinical areas that physicians could potentially go into and looked at the hiring environment now, and you ranked them as, you know, at the top of the list for ones that seem to be hiring the most physicians and using the most, maybe it's in the IT or informatics, where would pharmaceutical jobs be kind of in that hierarchy? If you could even estimate that.
Stephen, you want to take a stab at this?
I think you hit it in terms of where the most explosive growth is in information services, information technology, pharmaceutical industry. Gosh, you know, whether it would be third or fourth or, you know, is compared to the managed care insurance industry as is compared to, you know, I would say probably number two, if you know, and maybe even number one would be the provider side, right? So all of the non-clinical or partial, perhaps partial clinical / hybrid positions in large medical groups and hospitals and physician organizations and physician hospital organizations would probably actually be number one, but pharmaceuticals is certainly you know, still a substantial tranche, particularly as Joe is incorporated into our discussion over the last two sessions. That includes the services providers, the industry that services the pharmaceutical industry, the so-called medical communications industry.
Mm-hmm. Right, and those aren't the only ones. I mean, there are certainly groups like the contract research organizations or CROs. There are so many other servicing organizations
right.
that provide services for the pharma industry. So I think given the volume, it's simply just the sheer volume of how large the pharmaceutical industry is, and given also the fact that I'm seeing a lot of job posts looking for all sorts of physicians or just people who have clinical experience ranging from, you know, VP of Medical Affairs to Medical Director to MSL to Medical Writer. The jobs are certainly out there, and people are hiring. So it's hard to put a number to it, but it is one of those areas where it's going to be near the top. And even though there's a massive explosion in health IT, the majority of the hiring is certainly not at the physician level. They're hiring people like programmers, project managers, nurses. They're hiring a lot of other non-physicians within this explosive growth of the health IT industry. So if we looked at just sheer numbers of how many physicians are becoming employed in 2010 versus 09 versus 08, and if we were to try to predict in 2011, personally, I think that the pharma industry would still be number one because it's so big. And even though health IT is big, they're not employing a dramatically high volume of physicians. They're employing a lot of other non-physicians, but I just don't see that kind of hiring occurring like you would see in the pharma industry.
Thank you.
Sure. So with that, I guess, you know, I want to just thank everyone again for joining us tonight. You've got access to our email addresses, you know, Stephen Peston's email addresses on the website. I want to thank you for joining us, and if you have any other questions that you'd like to follow up with, you know, we welcome those emails as well. And sort of the last comment that I always like to end with is just to remind everyone that the transition is not always easy to leave clinical medicine and to enter industry. Some people have a much easier time given that they have a lot of connections or they understand much more or they just happen to be lucky. But there are services available through people like Stephen Peston and others who provide career coaching and mentoring services. And so this is something that if you're really serious about investing in time and energy, that's something that you should definitely look into. So I don't know if, Stephen, you want to add any closing comments or closing remarks tonight?
Just, you know, enjoy the two sessions that we've done. And as Joe said, information's available at nonclinicaljobs.com. And it's been a pleasure speaking with some of you for two sessions and for others of you for the session this evening. And The opportunities, as Joe said, are certainly there, and the, you know, again, just reemphasize the importance of digging and sourcing and networking, whether it be through individuals from your residency program, your medical school, individuals that you've gotten to know perhaps that work in the pharmaceutical industry who might be neighbors or that you've had some interaction with in your career as resources.
Great. Well, thank you again, everyone, and we look forward to having a call again later this year, and if so, just stay tuned. It'll be posted on Non-Clinical Jobs as to when the next call will be. So with that, thank you, and good night.
Have a good evening.
Bye-bye. Good night.